Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, November 27th, less than a month till Christmas. Time is flying along. My name is Magnus Thiebald. I'm your host for today, and joining me is Peter Haskell.
Yes, I'm here.
He is indeed here, right over there. Joining us shortly will be Ayu Sakamoto. And we have some interesting stuff for today's show. We have an interview with Dr. Joanna Ashworth about democracy in the classroom and in democracy in teaching and learning. It's a two-part interview, and we'll be playing the other part, part two, tomorrow on Speak Up. Peter's here. And what are you going to talk about today, Peter?
It's about there's a Filipino group. I went to their karaoke last night, but I also got some information Sunday afternoon about them.
Great.
About what the situation is.
Excellent. I was going to be here shortly. Normally she does her artist profile, but today she has a giveaway about an upcoming event. And she'll talk about that event and play some music from it. So that's something to look forward to. And of course, there is always Bird Note, as we usually do. And we'll have a documentary to play for you later in the program, plus some great music. We're going to start off, though, with my interview that I did on Friday with Dr. Joanna Ashworth about democracy and democratic ideas in teaching and learning. It's about SFU, but it also extends to the more broadly to the idea of post-secondary education and learning and the role of universities in promoting democracy and democratic thought within society. Ayu's here. Hello, Ayu.
Hello.
Well, let's play our interview here, and then we'll get on with the show. Welcome to Dr. Joanna Ashworth. You are a research associate with the Community Engaged Research Initiative at Simon Fraser University. And you've been doing research into democracy in the classroom. Perhaps you can introduce yourself first, and then we'll talk a bit more about your research.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. So as you say, I'm a research associate with CERI, Community Engaged Research Initiative, which is a really interesting unit within the university that looks at and partners with communities around issues of concern for those communities, brings kind of a matchmaking of researchers from the university to communities around specific issues. And I've been there for a few years working on various projects, but the reason why I landed there is because I've been working for many years on this project called Participedia.net, which is a global study of, a SHRC-funded global study of innovations in participatory democracy. And so it's documenting the kinds of things that are really trying to create a more participatory, more deliberative, more actively engaged democratic system in various parts of the world in many contexts. And it's just looking at what works, why, and where. And so through that work and through the kind of research that I have been oriented towards, which has always been community driven, I was invited to come to CERI and do some projects there. So the research on democratic teaching and learning really came out of my Participedia work. And I was invited by the VP of research at the time, who was Joy Johnson, to to conduct this study, which was looking at the practice of democratic teaching and learning at Simon Fraser University. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's lots of great examples at SFU where teaching and learning is very innovative, like the Semester in Dialogue, the City Studio project, the labs that the health labs that have been done in Surrey with Paola Ardiles. And there's so many people that are kind of well known for doing really innovative work that engages communities, that looks at issues that of their concern, which I really see as kind of the heart of democratic teaching and learning, is looking at where we can have agency and looking at where we can make a difference in terms of what's happening in a particular setting, in a particular context or policy arena. So this study really was meant to be a kind of a phenomenology of who's doing work kind of in the privacy of their classrooms, not necessarily mm-hmm. in these high profile programs, but, you know, behind the doors of the classroom, what's happening? What are these instructors, whether they're full professors or sessionals, what are they doing that's innovative in terms of bringing a more democratic approach to the pedagogies that they are working with? So that was really the beginning of the study. And I worked with a number of colleagues, including Brenda Morrison, Am Johal, Paola Ardiles, Tara Mahoney. And together we kind of designed the research. And mm-hmm. We found 12 people within the university that are kind of known, or who have made themselves known because of the work that they're doing, and not necessarily really well known outside of their discipline, let's say. And we spent a lot of time talking to them through these semi-structured interviews and gathered those transcripts and did a survey of SFU-wide survey, anyone that was teaching, of PhD students to full professors. We didn't get a huge response. We got 31 respondents and who completed the full survey. And so from that, we ascertained some, you know, some premises that we've been building on. So we did our research. We created a report, and then part of our commitment to the VP of research was to have a symposium. Of course, this was right mm-hmm. in the middle of COVID. So,
of course.
Yeah. You know, most of our plans went sideways, but we held a symposium online, and we took some of these ideas. And one of the strong ideas that came out of the research was that the classroom should be boundless, you know, mm-hmm. that a democratic classroom is really a boundless classroom.
Yeah. The basic idea of what you're looking into and trying to discover how people are implementing it, this is the idea of democracy in teaching and learning. So what exactly does that mean for you? Yeah. Or is that something that actually came out of you learned through the study?
Well, I know we had an intention going ahead with this research that there was something going on, that people were thinking about democracy and they were thinking about their own teaching practice through a democratic lens. But we wanted mm-hmm. to know what that looked like in practice. So when we talk about democracy, of course, there are reams and reams of studies and books written about what we mean by democracy. And that can become hugely complex in and of itself. But I would say, you know, we think of democracy as an ideal system of governance. You know, it's a way of making decisions. It's a way of the people being represented through, you know, now we think about a representational democracy or electoral democracy as, you know, all the people have a vote, everyone has a say, mm-hmm. you know, so that's the ideal. But of course, it's an unfinished project. And I would say democracy right now is a project under threat, mostly because of truth decay. You know, there's a real decay in what we consider to be the facts, you know, a consensus around basic facts of how our society is and what should be done. And there's a, you know, opinion seems to be more important than facts. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of a lack of civic discourse, you know, where people can disagree and do it civilly and respectfully. There seems to be a demonization of people who don't agree with each other. There's a, you know, polarization and sort of mistrust in our basic institutions, including the media. And I, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think the experience of democracy for many, including students, including, you know, many of us, is one of alienation, of, you know, we're not really, we'll do things all over on the side, but we're not really going to buy into the democratic system, because it really isn't working for many people. You know, but of course, if we took away the vote from people, even if many people don't bother to vote, there'd be a huge outcry. But, you know, so it is about trying to find ways in which people can participate in decisions that affect their lives. And often that happens at a very local context. When we get into global issues, it feels like it's very far away from our ability to affect change. But it's really about, you know, inclusion. I mean, for me, this unfinished project of democracy really is about this ideal of having inclusion, have communities that respect each other, where there's equality of standing, freedom of expression, and freedom from oppression, you know, freedom to act and do within constraints, you know. And most recently, I ran a summer school with the Participedia team and many of us from Siri that looked at radical democracy. And right. by radical, we mean like a deeper, more participatory democracy. And of course, if you think about what democracy means in the Greek, it's demos and katos. And demos is the people, and katos is really about power.
Right.
Power, it's either power to create or power to disrupt. And right. so, you know, in some cases, we need to negotiate power, we need to share power, and we need to fight power. And so I think that kind of more radical definition of democracy is really useful. It's within a constraint of democracy. It's not saying we're all going to become anarchists. It's saying within a democratic, you know, set of norms and values and institutions, there's things we can do
right.
to improve the lives of many and not be governed, you know, the tyranny of the few. So how that translates in the classroom is really interesting, and it's quite different depending on who you are and what you're teaching.
So what did you find from talking to these educators?
Oh, so many things. You know, so through the interviews and through the survey and just, you know, having follow-up conversations in the symposium, I think we learned that teachers will define democracy in different ways, and sometimes it's not even as explicit as you would think. There's no sort of theory of democracy that's guiding, but there's a kind of implicit, you know, when you look at what people do in practice, they will say, for example, people have the right, people like students, and more broadly, the community have a right to a say in a meaningful sense about the decisions that affect their lives. It means that people need to have skills and knowledge to be able to engage with political systems. Democracy in education means it's people need to decide together what matters, what set the agenda, define the issues, and decide what controversies or conflicts they want to deal with and dive into, and to actually create the questions themselves. So taking some kind of ownership over the learning is, you know, was a really strong theme. It's reflected, I think, in more how the instructor, the professor goes about teaching, as opposed to what is the discipline that they're teaching, what is right. the knowledge that they're imparting. It's like the how are we doing this? It seems to be a really strong indicator of, you know, how democratic can this classroom be? You know, and you can kind of see it on a continuum. It's like to full sharing of power, including grading, which is a kind of a very radical way of thinking about evaluation and, you know, who gets to decide on the grades. And of course, traditionally, it is the instructor that makes the grades, but there are degrees of power sharing where students evaluate each other's work, where they have a much more of a say in, you know, the kinds of things they want to do that would show that they're learning and demonstrate to the instructors and to each other. In our Democracy Summer School, which was a credit program, we had an ungrading system, which is, you know, there's a whole movement around ungrading, which is there's no grade, but there's a pass or fail. And then the students themselves decide on what the criteria will be. You know, what is a pass? You know, what does it mean to do the work? And it really, the focus is more on the learning than on the evaluation. So understanding, you know, for example, helping students understand what possibilities they might have in terms of creating the curriculum, deciding what the projects, the study projects would be, or how they want to work together. So, you know, degrees of freedom and power to make decisions are, I think, is really one of the big drivers. But mm-hmm. of course, you know, there are classrooms where the actual content of the classroom is around democracy.
Right.
Whether you're in criminology, political science is an obvious one, history. So looking at political systems and being able to understand those systems, but also doing it in a way that is deliberative, that is participatory, that has an emphasis on dialogue versus sort of a unidirectional downloading of knowledge from professor to student. It's much more conversational. One of the faculty that I've spent some time with in the symposium and in the summer school, Genevieve Fuji Johnson, teaches political science. Mm-hmm. And her view of teaching in it with a democratic lens is really to give fewer readings to students, give them more opportunity to engage with the material and to talk with each other about what that material means to them in their own lives. You know, and assuming that it's material that relates to bigger issues, whether it's right. colonization or, you know, political systems or, you know, decision making and policy making.
Right. So what might that look like in the classroom?
There's a lot of really interesting things that people are doing. You know, they're mm-hmm. just rearranging the furniture. As you probably know, in most of the classrooms, the furniture is fixed and it's lined mm-hmm. up in a very kind of medieval fashion that, you know, works in a lot of cases where there's, you know, there are big classrooms and class size can be, you know, one of the big impediments to fully engaging in it with democratic pedagogies. But you know, moving the classroom around, either into smaller groups or into one large circle, which kind of in itself demonstrates that, you know, we're doing things a bit differently here. Field trips, you know, getting out of the classroom, meeting people in their communities, talking to people about the issues that are affecting them, you know, obviously relevant to the content of the course. One professor in the School of Communication has a course on social issues. The students define the projects, they research the projects themselves, mm-hmm. they always involve a community partner, they have a public forum that presents their research findings with the partner, and they self-evaluate. You know, so those are pretty, I would say they're simple, because they take a lot of thought and they take a lot of work in terms of developing relationships outside of the classroom. But those kinds of courses are extremely valued by students in terms of just learning that what they do has consequence, what they're learning and how they're learning actually matters, you know, and it's making a difference in not only in their lives, but because they're learning and changing and becoming more critically aware, but they're actually supporting and helping a community organization with that they've identified. So that's one way. I mean, I think sometimes it is really simple in terms of just asking students, what do you want to focus on? You know, giving them mm-hmm. a little bit more control over the material, that kind of thing.
How significant do you think that is in student satisfaction? Because I don't think anybody really likes just getting a lecture.
I think, of course, not all students are the same, and their ability to live with ambiguity and the chaos that is often part of taking a bit more control in what's mm-hmm. going to, you know, how you're going to design and run a course. You know, we all know if you've taught that, you know, designing a course is a lot of work. So I think there's, you know, some students are really, really enjoy that. And they appreciate the opportunity to be uncomfortable and to actually contribute their ideas. And other students would prefer that you just lay it on them. And that, I think that's understandable. And I think we have to respect that and try to find a way where people are going to feel the right amount of discomfort, you know, mm-hmm. that it's actually going to be good for their learning and not completely, you know, create so much stress that they can't learn at all.
Right.
So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but some of the things that, people have said is that, you know, by being able to take control, they recognize that they actually do have more agency than they, recognize. Working collaboratively, I think, are, you know, those are the kinds of skills that you need outside of the classroom, and that they're not always easy. Being able to talk about issues that are challenging, that are deeply personal sometimes, you know, particularly we're thinking about what's happening in the Middle East. There's really tough conversations that are maybe being avoided in classrooms because either the professor doesn't feel adequately skilled enough to manage those conversations, so they just get shut down, or students are, you know, feeling like they have to defend their points of view in a way that they're not comfortable doing. So, you know, trying to find that, you know, in the tension of, you know, the classroom as a free space of exploration and critical thinking, and where anything is possible to be discussed, and that often sometimes, you know, classrooms can be a space of oppression and lack of inclusion, where people feel, particularly BIPOC students or Indigenous students, may feel like their points of view will not be respected, or that they feel like they have to represent their particular community, and they're not comfortable doing that. And why should they be? So those kinds of tensions mean that the instructors need to be skilled and to be comfortable in actually befriending conflict, you know, and not shutting it down. But there's a skill, I think, involved in, you know, in dealing with controversy and issues of conflict.
And we're going to pause that interview there. That is part one of a two-part interview with Dr. Joanna Ashworth. She is a researcher, educational planner, and filmmaker, and she's also a research associate with CERI, which is the Community Engaged Research Initiative at SFU, Simon Fraser University. And it is in that capacity that she conducted this study into democratic teaching and learning. We're going to be playing part two of the interview tomorrow morning at about 5 minutes after 10. So if you'd like to hear the rest of it, please tune in then. It'll also be posted online at our website at www.cgsf.ca, both today's program and tomorrow's program. If you're interested in reading more about it, the discussion paper that she's talking about in the research they did, talking to educators here at SFU, was called Democratic Teaching and Learning, a Study of Practice at Simon Fraser University. If you Google for that, Democratic Teaching and Learning SFU, you should be able to find it pretty simply. It's quite an accessible report. You don't have to be an expert in the field to understand it. And if it's an issue that interests you, I recommend checking it out. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is a Speak Up. Ayu is here in the studio with me. Hello.
Hello.
And you want to talk about an event, and we have a giveaway for
today. Yeah.
Take it away.
Yeah. So today I don't introduce to artists like I usually do, but instead I have some exciting news to share with you. And there's an amazing music concert coming up, and we have two tickets just for you. And let me give you all the details. So ARI Music Vancouver and the Vancouver Chamber Choir are bringing back the timeless Christmas classic Handel's Messiah to celebrate the festival season. And we want to make sure you're there in the audience to experience this incredible performance. And the concert will take place on December 8th, 2023 at 7:30 p.m. at the Orpheum. What makes this event even more special is that it's the first time these renowned Baroque specialists and the Vancouver Chamber Choir are performing together. And led by the conductor Alexander Wayman, they will be accompanied by the exceptional Pacific Baroque Orchestra. And the performance will feature an incredible lineup of soloists, the soprano Sherzade Pasaki, the alto Allison McCarty, the tenor Nicholas Scott, and the bass Jonathan Adams. Each of them will perform from memory, adding extra layer of magic to Handel's Messiah. So we have a pair of tickets, and you could be the lucky winner. So now let me tell you how you can win those tickets. It's very simple. Just please send us an email explaining why you'd love to experience Handel's Messiah concert. And don't forget to include your name and contact information and send it to cjsfae@marksfu.ca. The deadline for entry is this Friday, December 1st, and we'll send the email back to the lucky winner, and later tickets will be sent via email too. So I'm so excited to share this amazing opportunity with you, so don't miss out. And so let me tell you how you can win tickets again. So send an email explaining why you'd love to experience Handel's Messiah concert. And our email is cjsfae@marksfu.ca.
Yep. So that's cjsfae@sfu.ca. And that'll go to our A&E coordinator here at CJSF. And they will pick a winner before the end of the week. So that's for, sounds terrific, performance of Handel's Messiah with a full orchestra and numerous solo solo artists contributing as well. Sounds like a terrific holiday night out for a lucky pair of folks.
I think so.
Excellent. So we have some music here. This isn't this is a performance from the London Symphony Orchestra, but it is of Handel's Messiah, to give you a bit of a flavor of what you will be experiencing if you're the lucky winner or if you attend this show.
I will play the Messiah Part 1, Number 12, for Unto As a Child Is Born by George Frederick Handel. Okay.
Apologies, that's very quiet, that bit of music. I hope you could still hear and enjoy that. That was Handel's Messiah is performed by the London Symphony Orchestra. That's just to give you a bit of a taste of what will be happening on December 8th. Tell us once again about the performance and the giveaway.
So December 8th, so Friday, next week's Friday, at 7:30 p.m. at the Orpheum, there is a music concert, and ARI Music Vancouver and the Vancouver Chamber Choir collaborating, and so they will play Messiah. So yes, yep. And you can get the ticket by sending an email to us, and you can, yeah, there's a possibility. So,
yep, send an email with just a short comment about why you'd like to experience this performance. Send that to cjsfae@sfu.ca before this Friday. One entry per person. Don't get greedy and spam our A&E coordinator's inbox with your request, one per person. And we will choose a lucky winner on Friday, and that person will be notified. And you will get to go to the concert. So I think it's a awesome opportunity. And thank you, Ayu, for coming in to tell us about it today.
Yeah, thank you. I also attend the event, and I will also plan to review it.
Great.
So I'm excited too.
Excellent. And you'll come back here and tell us about it?
Yeah.
After the concert. Great. That's terrific. All right. Let's have a quick look at today's weather. And this week's weather here in the Vancouver region. It's a pretty cool, foggy and overcast day for today. High up to 7, it'll be down to 0 overnight. The sun's going to come out a bit for Tuesday and Wednesday with a mix of sun and cloud on both days, highs to 6 degrees and lows down to 1 degree. And then the cloud comes back in on Wednesday evening, and we'll have sort of middling weather with overcast through the rest of the week and some rain showing up on Friday and the weekend. So that's your look at the weather for this week. Next up, this is we have a song here for you from Canadian band Metric. They've been putting out records for 15 years now. They have a new one called Formentera 2. This is the lead-off single from that track. This is Detour Up. We'll be right back. Metric. That was from a new album from them, fairly new anyway, Formentera 2. That track was Detour Up. And joining me in the studio now is Peter. What have you come to talk to us about today,
well,
Peter?
It's actually Grabalerial BC. Saying it wrong anyway. Yeah. It's an anti-imperialist Filipino women's organization.
Yeah.
But they... there was a karaoke in Surrey last night, kind of a fundraiser, and men are involved
for the event.
Yes,
yeah.
So men are involved with it too. I wasn't the only one there, but I guess it concerns itself with Filipino women as such,
yeah.
And also the temporary workers coming in to Canada and Vancouver. One thing is, I didn't know that. I heard it on CBC Radio, actually. Divorce is illegal in the Philippines, and it's now, besides Vatican City, now the only place in the world where it is illegal. And also, I asked a bit about this, about the temporary workers. You have to be a citizen of Canada if you want to get a divorce, I guess, if you came from the Philippines. So that is, I can sort of see where there's a group about that. Yeah. It's also the concern is, I think, the other thing is that there is a nursing shortage in the Philippines because so many of them go out of the Philippines to other countries like Canada. And strangely enough, they sort of encourage that. It's a very strange regime in the Philippines. 80% of the population happens to be Catholic. So, okay. Before going to the event, I went over the internet a few other things.
Yeah.
In 2017, this is under Justin Trudeau government, Canada sold 16 combat helicopters worth $185 million to the Philippines Air Force. And there were complaints about that at the time. Maybe too, I did a few other things. $1.1 million from Canada to the Philippines for the pandemic. And $12 million from Canada, the Philippines, climate, finance, women, certain other things. So they've gotten some foreign aid, but that seems a bit odd to me that in 2017 that happened. That's a lot of money, $185 million.
Of course, you know, when we do that, we're selling them. We're not just giving them money. They're getting, you know, they're buying Canadian-made helicopters, so Canada's benefiting immensely from such a transaction.
One thing is that there's a mining. There's a lot of mining in the Philippines. And a lot of the mining is by Canadian firms.
Yep.
And 70. This is a worldwide situation. 75% of the world's mining companies are headquarters in Canada. And 60% of them are on the IMA or on the stock exchange over in Toronto. So, and there's been problems actually. But the Fifth Estate did an article in 2015 about a East African country, and it was a Vancouver mining firm. And basically, they were taking advantage of slave labor because this country was employing slave labor and so on. So we're, and there's problems with the Philippines too.
Yeah, they definitely had a lot of issues with their recent governments there. They're still basically democratic in the sense that they, you know, they do have elections and stuff, but they seem to have, you know, there's more to democracy than elections in some of the recent governments. Certainly the one of Duterte, who is before the current government, engaged in a lot of
well, there was
a lot of practices involving sort of extrajudicial murders and whatnot that not that democratic.
Well, what they have now is the son of Marcos.
Yes, I've seen that too. He's the son of Ferdinand Marcos, who was the dictator of the Philippines for a couple decades at least, and was sort of pushed out of power in a bit of a democratic revolution quite a while ago, when there was sort of a bit of a wave of these kind of things happening around the world. And unfortunately, perhaps we're seeing some backsliding within the Philippines on effective democracy.
Well, I have a results of that election. It was May 9th, 2022, and Marcos got 58% of the popular vote, and the independent got 28%.
Right.
And anyway.
But also, you know, you could say part of a larger trend happening throughout much of the world, in which right-wing and fundamentally anti-democratic groups are gaining sway, even in established democracies. Just, I think it was last week in the Netherlands, they had an election, and the group that got the largest number of seats, they didn't get a majority of seats to form the government, but got the largest plurality of seats, was a far right-wing group. And perhaps it's a good thing that at the moment they're having trouble finding coalition partners that would allow them to establish a government. But, you know, we've seen that in other countries. Hungary for many years now, and of course, you know, the whole Trump thing happening down in the States, and despite all the stuff he says and has done, he's still the number one, you know, the leading candidate for the Republican Party. So
another thing, maybe add, but the first Ferdinand Marcos,
yeah,
he was in power from 1965 to 1986, and the woman who took over, there was a lot of kind of hope for it, but I didn't kind of check into that. But I remember at the time there was people mm-hmm. weren't quite happy that it wasn't quite the reforms people were hoping for. No, this thing, I wonder about divorce being illegal. I mean, they didn't think to make that legal at that time period, I suppose.
Nope. So jumping back to where we started, Gabriela BC is an anti-imperialist Filipino women's organization. They had a fundraiser just last night that you were at to raise money for their organization. And they have a Facebook page. You can find it at Gabriela BC 604. Find out more about their organization and some of their upcoming events and activities. So just looking at their Facebook page, they're pretty active with a lot of posts and events being organized. If that's something you're interested, look up Gabriela BC. I find it pretty easy to find the info about them online. And if you want to find out more about them, you can do that too. All right, any last thoughts there?
I guess what the organization is concerned with is the actual workers here mm-hmm. in Canada and around the Vancouver area,
right.
Vancouver area, because that's actually there was actually a problem. Sometimes they're brought over here and they're not paid or whatever. So there's many issues with mm-hmm. how the either the temporary workers or people coming here to get Canadian citizenship and how that's handled.
And just how they're being treated in the workplace and as employees.
Right.
Yeah. Good stuff. Well, thanks for coming in to talk about that today, Peter.
Okay.
Excellent. We're going to play some music for you now. This is Jeremy Dutcher. He's a First Nations artist who's really made a name for himself. Currently the number one album on campus community radio across Canada. This is from a new album, which is called... I'm going to do my best to pronounce this properly. Moto Wolanuuk. I think that's pretty good. Moto Wolanuuk. I haven't actually heard it pronounced. I've only read it. I haven't heard it pronounced out loud, so that may not be a great pronunciation. But yeah, and we're going to play this track from you, from Jeremy Dutcher. Jeremy Dutcher from his album Motuwola Nuuk. And again, I'm going to. That was the second track from the album, which is called. Let's give this a try. Poma Wusuna Nuuk Wona Kiwa Wola Nuuk. Doing my best here. Jeremy Dutcher from his new album. Next up, we have our intern Joy, who's here visiting with us from Korea for 4 more weeks. Went out to talk to students on campus last week about AI, and here is what they had to say.
Have you used AI like ChatGPT or others for your assignments?
Yeah, my name is Fahad. I'm just a student majoring in biometrics. I've been using ChatGPT just to get information, like knowledge, and even for assignments as well. But I would, you know, not prefer to, you know, copy paste whatever. See, just learn mostly. I would do, yeah. But I'm using them for sure.
What is your take on AI?
I mean, I think I do see it dominating in the future as well. It's just going to keep on growing, I believe so, because when it burst out, it was just, you know, like very popular, and over time it may just, it will grow up to the point that it will replace a lot of jobs that people are doing.
My name is Rina, and I think that AI is useful, but we just need to be careful because it has a lot of effects on our environment because it emits a lot of carbon fumes, and we also have to make sure that we stay honest because a lot of people use it in assignments.
Hi, my name is Natalie. I'm a first year at SFU. I actually have never used AI before. I'm not really familiar with how it works, but I feel like it can be very useful, especially like in terms of studying. It can give you like really good notes and things like that, but for me personally, I'd rather just like come up with my own ideas, and I feel like that way you learn better anyway. So
what is your take on AI?
My name's Lucci. I'm kind of neutral. It's like, I understand for some people, if they want to figure out like a simple definition or taking notes, it's like easier to like summarize what they read or something. But if it's like for assignments that they have to make and they use ChatGPT, I think obviously it's bad because it's not their own work. But I don't really care because not me.
I'm Emmanuel. I mean, I just hear a lot of people like using it for their assignments. I'd say it's a useful tool, but maybe some people like use it in a bad way. Maybe like, oh, do my work for me. But personally, I haven't used it that much. I only used it for like to explain, because I'm in science. I use it to explain science concepts in maybe a simpler way. So, but yeah, I hear a lot of people like using AI to maybe do their work for them. And I don't know how to feel about that.
I'm Aryan Kaul. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a useful tool, but at the same time, say, you know, you're trying to further in your degree, do well in your classes. Yeah, it might get you the better grade, but also, like, our generation, we're kind of like the future, and if our future's in the hands of, like, us, and we're kind of using AI to kind of do well and further our knowledge, it's probably not the best thing.
Mm-hmm. Are we really doing the work?
Yeah, are we really doing the work? Because once we're doing the work, you know, we can actually trust ourselves in whatever field we go into.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Ava. I think AI can be helpful. I wouldn't rely on it entirely for an assignment for school. Often I use it to get an outline or highlight some important topics. I don't use it entirely to do an assignment, but it can definitely be helpful and give you some unique perspectives.
Thank you to Kay for putting together that streeter on AI. AI is, of course, perhaps the big tech story of 2023, and it's been pretty amazing to watch it. I mean, it's been around for a lot of years, but it really blasted into both the public perception, but also, you know, financially with AI-related companies achieving huge valuations very quickly this year. Thanks to Kay for putting that together. It's a big issue in academia, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that again. Here is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note.
If you see a feather on the ground, I'm sure 99% of the people will pick it up and see it and imagine which bird it came from.
Isha Munshi co-founded the Feather Library, a digital library that collects and documents the feathers of Indian birds. Launched in 2021, the library has high-resolution photographs of about 90 bird species, like the brilliantly colored Indian pita and the wispy tail feathers of the white-tailed swallow. Each feather is carefully documented. These are birds that came to a rescue center in Gujarat, India, but didn't survive. Isha trained under Vanya Rova at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and learned how to prepare the feather specimens.
It's learning at every process because very few people in the world do something like this.
The digital library offers a glimpse into the birds that aren't seen in most photos, like the details of their flight feathers, which are hidden when the bird is perching.
Wire-tailed swallows' wires have like a fork at their end of their wires, which is like the microscope level I'm talking about.
This library is open to everyone, whether you're a researcher, bird watcher, conservationist, or an ordinary person who came across a feather.
I dream that someday Feather Library will have all the species of the world nicely catalogued for anyone to see.
Find a link to the Feather Library at our website, birdnode.org. I'm Ananya.
All right, you're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're coming very quickly to the conclusion of our program for today. Thank you for listening. Ayu is going to tell us once more about our giveaway.
Yeah, so we have two tickets for the concert, Handel's Messiah. And this is, so don't forget to send an email to us. The email address is cjsfae@marksfu.ca. Yeah.
So cjsfae@sfu.ca. And that's for the performance of Handel's Messiah on December 8th. You can win two tickets to that show. And it'll be, I think, a really fine time. I was going to be there enjoying it herself.
Yes.
And that could be you as well. So send in your entry to win those tickets. Thanks for joining us today, Peter. Talk about Gabriella, BC.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
And I think we'll all be back next week with some more interesting content. Part two of our interview with Dr. Joanna Ashworth about democratic teaching and learning will be on Speak Up tomorrow at a few minutes after 10, along with some more interesting content and documentaries and Bird Note and some good music. Thanks for joining me today, guys.
Yeah, thank
okay.
you.
Yes.
We're going to finish off with some new music from Toro e Moi. They are a band. They have a new track on our playlist, which is called Back Then, from their album Sandhills. This will play us out. Democracy Now! Is coming up in about a minute and a half. Stay tuned.
I was coming home, and I stayed for 3 months. Spent the summer in South Carolina, doing what I want. Clouds as tall as mountains, it was humid as can be. Carolina sun was burning up everything. Carolina sun was burning up everything, everything.